It is time to put on your happy face because Siddhartha Shah is returning to our store. I think this might be the fourth time that you've spoken here. We do not invite many people back so many times, but every presentation that he has given has been a wonderful experience for our audience, for myself, and so we're looking forward. I'm especially looking forward to tonight's subject, Darshan, on the worship of images in Hindu practice, because I know of the practice of Darshan as it applies to the intimate or not so intimate relationship between teacher and student, but here we have an application that is one that you can actually bring into your daily life, into your daily practice, in a way that I'm really looking forward to hearing Siddhartha's thoughts about. So, welcome back.
Thank you. And it's nice to see familiar faces as well. So thank you for coming back to hear me speak. I'm going to start off by saying, it's been quite a while since I was here, I think. It's been months. A number of things have changed. I had dinner with Rob and Stuart and was talking with them about this. And in a nutshell, the more I deepen in the subject matter, sacred art, the harder it is to speak with as much confidence as I used to. The harder it is to be as comfortable with the subject matter. And what becomes more and more clear is how immense the mystical dimension is to this process of seeing. So this might be very different than the talks I've given in the past. This topic is one I've spoken about a lot in the past few months, and I was looking at the notes I have for this talk yesterday, and I have literally etched out page after page after page of this. For some reason, it just doesn't apply right now. So I'm really hoping for some of your assistance, because the thing, it's like I started at this point, I got here, and now I feel like I don't know anything about the subject matter. But where I want to start is with a story. I often begin with a story. I might have started with this story in the past, but it's always very relevant. And it's the story of Andal. Does this sound familiar to anyone? The story of a young girl who worshipped Vishnu. Okay, then it's new. Andal is a historical figure. She lived in the 1500s in South India. And the story is that she was discovered by a Brahmin who was plowing a field. He saw this baby, and he picked her up, and he decided to raise her as his daughter. Now, his specific role in the temple was that he would make flower garlands for the image of Vishnu. So he would string the flowers every day on string, and then present them to the statue of Vishnu in the temple, and then the priest would put it around Vishnu's neck. Now, as Andal was growing up, she loved flowers. And what they say is he would have a garland of flowers ready to take to the temple, and when he wasn't looking, Andal would come, and she'd smell the flowers, put the garland on, and dance around with it. Now, the thing is in India, you know, I have a natural habit not to smell flowers when I see them. Because typically when there are flowers around my home, it was meant for a temple. And you do not smell the flowers that you're taking to the temple. It's a rule, kind of. You don't take the fragrance in. You reserve the fullness of the fragrance for the deity or for the teacher that you're presenting the flowers to. So Andal would take these flowers and just, you know, smother her face in them, dance around with it, and then put them back on the tray so her father didn't know. She also used to joke that she would one day marry Vishnu. One day her father found a strand of her hair on this garland of flowers, and he realized that she'd been playing with them. So he reprimanded her, and he said, "Do not touch these flowers, don't smell them, and don't play with them. They're for Vishnu." And that night he had a dream where Vishnu said to him, "You know, please let her play with those flowers. I love to have her smell on the flowers when I wear them. So let her play with them before you bring them to the temple." And so he did. It became a daily ritual. He would give the flowers to this young girl. She would play with them. And then he'd take them to the temple. So Andal thought, as she was becoming a teenager, that she would one day be Vishnu's wife. And when it came time for her to get married, her father was looking for a husband for her, and she refused. And then he had another dream. And the priest of that Vishnu temple had a dream. where Vishnu said, "Dress her up as my bride and bring her to my temple." So when she was 15 years old, they dressed her up as a bride, and they arrived at the temple. She ran into the temple. She hugged the image of Vishnu, and in that moment she disappeared. She was never seen from again. And she's worshipped as Bhudevi in South India, as a form of the mother goddess. She was a poet as well. So there's actual writing that she did when she was 13 and when she was 9. She composed sonnets and songs to God. And the reason I'm telling this story, it's a myth, but you can choose to believe it or not to. We believe it's true. But the reason I tell this story is because that statue of Vishnu was not just a statue. He took her as her bride. It was a living image. And what I want to point to is for the Hindu, I'm going to speak mostly about art in Hindu practice. There is no distinction between the form of a deity and the deity itself. There's no separation. Someone who has an issue with idolatry, let's say, if I have a statue of Vishnu here, they might want to, you know, break it from the view that that's not actually Vishnu you're worshipping a false idol. They could never understand, but for one who's an idol worshipper, there's no separation. So that's part of the Hindu relationship with images. I have spoken a lot about the use of art as a transformational tool. That's always been my interest. I've been interested in religious art, sexuality in religious art, religious art of ancient Greece, of ancient Rome, of Europe, all over the world. But there's very specific ways in which art are used in Buddhist practice and in Hindu practice. So I'm just going to jump to those areas to get to what darshan really is. In Tibetan Buddhism, art is used for visualization practice. For those of you who have attended these talks, this might sound very familiar. You don't have any tonkas in here, do you, at the moment? Are people here familiar with what a tonka painting is? It's a Tibetan scroll painting. I think he has photos of some that I saw earlier. It's a painting that is usually brocaded in silk and hanging on a wall. Is there?
No, there's a couple of these little things here, sort of giving people the idea.
I'll just use one of these.
Okay.
This is a photo of a tonka painting. What it is, it's a painting that's then brocaded in silk, and it's hung on a wall. Typically, it has a piece of fabric hanging over it. And that's a sort of a symbol for when you're actually going to experience the deity, you lift the veil. So then you can have a transmission, be in relationship with that image. It's visualization practice, which means underneath this image, what you can't see is an extremely complex system of measurements, proportions, and shapes. It's a very precise tradition of painting. If you want to be a creative artist, tonka painting is not for you. There's manuals to describe the size of everything and the color. So when you meditate on an image, a Tibetan image, you are memorizing the form, and the shapes underneath are actually supposed to go into you and transform you from within. So it's an actual technology. It's a refined spiritual technology for transformation. So this way of working with art is quite different from what we call darshan in India, I would say. Darshan is a very, very difficult thing to explain. You can translate it in English as seeing or auspicious seeing, but somehow it falls very, very short. Darshan, in my opinion, is the principal practice of Hindus around the world. And by that I mean most of the Hindus I know do not meditate every day. They don't do yoga. They haven't read the esoteric scriptures. What they do is pile into a car with the relatives and drive for many hours, 8 hours, to a temple where you'll see the image of a deity and you spend some time looking at it, and then you get back in your car and you drive home. There's really nothing else to it. In India, you have many, many temples along the streets, even, and in Nepal as well. And you'll see people walking, and they'll just kind of look, and they'll keep going. This is darshan. This is the central practice. It's one of the most important practices of Hinduism, you could say. But what's actually taking place is very, very difficult to talk about. And like I said, I used to be able to talk about it with a lot of confidence, but all my views are just in the process of changing right now. I used to believe that darshan was about the transmission from gaze to gaze. So many people are familiar with darshan in relation to a spiritual teacher. You'll have darshan of your teacher, which is sometimes that the teacher is sitting there, or there's a photo, and you look into the teacher's eyes, and the teacher looks into you, and you feel some sort of energetic exchange take place. It's a way of saying, I am showing all of me to you, and I am seeing all of you with my eyes. But it's much more than that. And it's where I'm going with darshan now is that it's simply about the amount of information we can take in with our eyes and how powerful that actually is. An example of this, you know, you can see an image of sacred art, and that's what I specialize in, and you can have a really positive, profound experience with it. But I just spent 4 days looking at horror films last week. I was looking at a lot of vampire movies. And my heart felt like it was racing for days. I felt very, very sensitive. I was filled with anxiety. And it was simply because I had been seeing these images so consistently that it was actually affecting the way that I was experiencing life. Alex Gray, who's a very famous artist, actually did a study on the autoimmune system where they were showing the film Poltergeist. And he tested people's autoimmune systems before going in to see that film and afterwards. And the systems were just plummeting on a lot of people. There's this idea of impression food, which I've talked about in the past. The food you eat becomes your body. But we have to understand the images we take in with our eyes also become our consciousness. The way we live, you know, advertisements, this violent films, all of it is communicating to us, and we're not fully aware of it. So the important thing right now is to draw attention away from those negative images and more towards life-inspiring forms, where I get into what darshan is. Can anyone speak to me about their personal experience of seeing sacred art as it is different from seeing other forms of art? Yes.
When I was in Korea, there was a national treasure, a Kuan Yin statue. It was about, I think it was like 900 years old. It had been placed in that temple. And it wasn't very big. It was about this tall and in a seated position. And the Kuan Yin, when you looked at it, it's like you felt the wind. Mm-hmm. You know, like you could actually feel, and I wasn't the only one who had that experience, you know, when we visited the temple, because the clothing and the hair on the statue were like a fresh breeze was blowing.
Yes.
And you could actually feel in the presence of that statue, you could enter that breeze. Mm-hmm. The strange thing about this statue was that it was hermaphroditic. There was mm-hmm. one female breast and one male mm-hmm. Chest. You know, like, it had a very feminine face and a mustache. And it didn't look, you know, I mean, when I mention those details, it sounds eccentric. And it looked completely natural.
It worked.
It looked completely natural. So that's my, I think that relates to it.
And would you say that was different from the experience of looking at a spiritual teacher and having or any sort of exchange with the eyes with a conscious being? These are the questions I'm facing now.
I'll have to think about that. I'm not sure.
I will say, this is where the whole topic, it's like, you know, you create a story that you believe is real about something, and then one day it cracks, or it has a crack in it.
Mm-hmm. You're getting older.
I really used to feel, you know, images of the deities are meant to express absolute perfection, divine perfection, in Buddhism, in Hinduism, in Christianity, in these Gothic cathedrals, at a time when people couldn't read, you'd have the 12 scenes of Christ, of the Passion. And it would communicate a tremendous amount. It would evoke devotion in the person looking at it. And there were instruction, you know, real teachings being communicated. But is that really auspicious seeing? Is that a transmission? And how is that transmission any different than a transmission that takes place looking at pornography? And what I mean by that is, I've used this as an example in talks in the past, in terms of how images affect the way we live. If you have someone looking at a lot of pornographic images all the time, let's say they're objectifying women in a very kind of, a very, very objectified way, do you suspect that that will affect that individual's relationships with women and their views on sex and their views on intimacy? Probably. But isn't that also some sort of transmission that's taking place? You know, darshan, as it is, I cannot define what it is anymore. Yes?
What's coming to me has to do with the object of art kind of defines the space that it occupies. So there is the intention of the artist, there's the inspiration which moved the artist to create the work in the first place. So they become intimate parts of the experience of the inhabitants of the occupation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very, because we are, the image is how do you say, projected on the retina, on your inner being. So the space that it is occupying up there is also occupying here. So it's a very intimate experience. And you can always tell when it's a kind of a sacred occupation versus a military occupation. Or, Does that address?
Honestly, I have no idea. Darshan, as in terms of what makes an object sacred?
It's an experience.
And it's, when I used to talk about art, sacred art, here, I'll use this as an example. This is a painting of Sukhasiddhi Yogini. She's the perfection of bliss Yogini. It's exquisite. Some of you have seen prints of this before. There's incredible detail in this work. She herself is supposed to be a perfected being. Every attribute she's holding, her posture, her gaze, everything communicates something that's intended to transform the viewer. There are stories in Hinduism. There's this one story of a man who wanted to be a warrior, but the teacher he wanted to study with wouldn't take him, and so he found a rock and worshipped it as if it was the teacher. And he learned everything that the teacher was teaching the actual students he had from looking at that rock. So with darshan, with auspicious seeing, you can have an image of Lakshmi, the goddess of beauty, let's say. But in Nepal, you also have a tree stump that's worshipped as Lakshmi. And people have the same transmission that takes place. There's a dimension to this that I just wonder if it's going to remain a mystery. And it makes it not as much fun to be able to draw conclusions about these things. This is a painting of Lakshmi. If you look at this from the viewpoint of a Hindu who does not separate an image of Lakshmi from Lakshmi herself, then a certain, like, blessing force can be perceived. She takes on a certain presence.
To me, sometimes it's a question of how can I receive that? I mean, sometimes I feel there's a lack in myself in looking at something.
Yes.
And be able to receive the energy that's there.
So maybe it's about intention, both mm-hmm. on the part of the artist and the viewer, and maybe something even greater than both of those. And intention is a doorway through which we can access that which is greater than both of those.
I guess you could say, in the past 2 years, I've been invited to speak all over the country as an expert on sacred art. And the whole thing is not making sense to me.
Yeah.
You're talking a lot about the power of belief
mm-hmm.
and personal belief, like the man with the rock, and then collective belief, which becomes even stronger. So if you have a 900-year statue that millions of people have been mm-hmm. believing in had powers for a long time,
mm-hmm.
that this consciousness itself, you're talking about the universe as consciousness, and that belief by itself is very, very strong.
I completely agree. What concerns me, I studied classical art when I studied art history. I studied classical Greek art. There was a time when Venus, or when Aphrodite, was a goddess. Zeus was king of heaven. These images were worshipped by thousands and thousands of people for thousands of years, actually. And now we're at a time where that religion itself is dead. But are those still sacred objects? You see, I have looked at images of classical Greek art and experienced what I would call darshan. There's a transmission that I've had from images of ancient art that were worshipped. And I've had experiences, divine experiences, with paintings like the beheading of Lady Jane, which is about Lady Jane about to be beheaded in England. You know, this notion of art in religion, art as transformational tool in religion, I'm having a hard time distinguishing it from art in society that's intended to transform, in the sense of advertising for anything, and the power of sacred art. It's
So I have a question.
Yeah.
You raised the example of having spent 4 days watching vampire movies. You raised the idea of pornography, and then there's an effect that looking at some of the images that you passed around have on us. So would you say, independent of our definitions or what categories you put this in, are there objective, discernible differences between the effects evoked by those different experiences?
That's the question. Is it...
So
yes.
Or another way to phrase that, you know, you mentioned that someone can see a Lakshmi by focusing on a stump.
Yeah.
Or someone can receive a transmission from a teacher by focusing on a rock. So there's certainly an element of the quality of attention that's being applied. Is that the only factor, or is there a factor, as Rob was saying, about the intention of that which gave rise to the image?
Yes. With this tradition, I'll talk a bit about the Newar art, because I do think there's something about the intention of the artist as well. Some of you know about this tradition of art, because I've talked about it. It began in the 1930s when an artist saw Botticelli's Birth of Venus, an artist in Nepal. And so it completely changed the history of Himalayan art. And the figures appear much more realistic and three-dimensional than previous images.
Is this an example of what you're talking about?
Yes, you don't see the Botticelli influence so much, but this is an example of a painting from that movement.
Mm-hmm.
I'll show you a Botticelli influence here.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
The artists paint these paintings to evoke a longing, to show the beauty of the gods and goddesses. And so there's a certain intention behind them, but the thing is these images are not hanging in temples. These paintings, religious art isn't serving the same function it used to. Images of the gods used to be created for temples and to be worshipped. These aren't serving that purpose anymore. For the individual who gets a piece, I actually love this tradition of art. I own a number of pieces, and I always talk about the profound experience I have of growing up or living with this work. I grew up in a home where there was sacred art everywhere. My mother said that wherever you stand in the house, God should see you and you should see God. It was everywhere. And I've always felt that had a huge impact on my upbringing and what I choose to look at and what I consider beautiful. And yet, I can't put my finger on why. I feel almost apologetic because this topic was a no-brainer several months ago. And then people started asking questions and the whole thing started falling apart. Yes?
Maybe I think part of what you're talking about, you know, like people, these paintings are not ending up in temples, they're not being worshipped. So they're being transformed into other purposes and uses.
Yes.
I remember years ago a troop of Trappists went around and to concert halls and they did Gregorian chant. Right? And I went and it was a concert.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a sacred occasion. Don't misunderstand me. It was beautiful.
Yes, yes, yeah.
I mean, you know, like the chanting was beautiful. But it was not what I would call worship, you know. Like, and there was something that I felt that was missing, you know. Like, because they came out like performers and they sort of lined up, and they had interesting costumes like performers do. And I read the reviews afterwards, and all the reviews were about the musical quality, the quality of the voices. I don't remember coming across a review about a transmission of holiness or that kind of thing. So I'm wondering if that's parallel to what you are referring to.
Yes, in some ways, yeah.
The context shifted.
it was exactly the same, perhaps the same chant, the same people who chanted, but the context shifted.
Right. Well, the Buddhist monks, the Tibetan monks, came through Santa Rosa a year or so ago and performed at Luther Burbank Center.
Right.
And I saw them, and they were very good, but they said they were doing it because they needed money. Mm-hmm. And it was not really worship. They were showing us what they did. And it was understood in that way, I think.
Yeah.
That it was representing what they did that was holy, but this was more secular showing of it. So.
I think this is really helping me understand some of the things that I'm talking about. Because there are master artists of this tradition who, when they paint and you see their works, it's as if you were looking into the face of God. Mm. It's such an incredible experience. And as the movement gets more and more recognition, you know, I started working with these artists and a man named Robert Beer about 2 years ago. And as it gets bigger and bigger, there's this grasping that's happening for the work. And there seems to be something not affecting the quality of the art, but it's almost a little bit scary. It's like this is getting very, very big, and people aren't seeing the work as they did 2 years ago. It's becoming a little bit more something to own. Mm-hmm. And so I think my experience is also becoming a little bit less of being this middleman between incredible sacred art and people who really want to appreciate it and work with it, into this fast kind of, you know, I need a Shiva. I really want a meditating Shiva. Can you get me a meditating Shiva? You know.
Quick.
Yeah, and it's like the whole, I'm not seeing the same distinction I used to between sacred art. And, you know, I used to sell Warhols in San Francisco. I sold one of Warhol's electric chairs for like $70,000 in 2002. And it was the same kind of a frenzy for that. Yeah?
Artists tend to wind up making the art that sells. And so what you're doing now that it's selling, instead of doing it as a worship of the god, they're now having to come forth with what's going to sell. When they say a meditative Shiva, you ask for that, they may not feel like
exactly
Shiva that week or that month. But
it's interesting to me because, as you described it, I see an analogy that we've often observed in spiritual traditions, where when a tradition is functioning as its original intention, it's a vehicle for transformation. When it becomes big, and this corporate mentality takes over, an organization begins to establish habit patterns to replicate itself and to sustain itself independent of what the original intention was.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems like a natural progression, you know, that where things become their opposite.
And the relationship changes.
And I think that is a little bit what's happening. I don't want it to sound like there's a shift in the quality of the work. They are remarkable.
Incredible.
But there's a fear that's setting in of it. Like I can't, like I was saying over dinner, I can't talk about darshan in the same way because something is shifting. I can't sit up here and just talk about how all sacred art has this is, you know, a wonderful transformative tool, regardless of what it is, and that every image is absolute divine perfection, because really it's up to the viewer and their relationship with it. And I think that's going to be true of sacred art, of pornography, of violence, of vampire movies, like I was saying. And I'm just really hoping that the people I work with this work maintain that relationship, or kind of maintain, keep understanding the importance of viewing this work rather than it just being something to own.
Well, let me explore that a little further then, because if that's what you want, then how do you help cultivate that? Mm-hmm. Then becomes the question. And part of that has to be the education of how
to establish the conditions of darshan, you have two obstacles, it seems to me. One is the one that we've just been talking about, this process of commodification that occurs, which is endemic to this particular, you know, I really have to see that. Take it away. Thank you. Wow. I'll look at that later. So there's this process of commodification, but then there's secondarily a general context where people don't have the relationship to this process of darshan that you and your mother and other people in the cultural matrix that she and you have grown familiar with lack.
Yes.
People here don't have that almost instinctual understanding of how this technology works. And I say almost instinctual because it is something that you implied from your description of your past that has arisen precisely as a result of a lifetime of impressions, especially at a young age, that nurtured this relationship and this ability to ingest these kinds of impressions in the way that you have been able to do. So here you have this place where people don't have that set of impressions. So what do you do?
Yes. Yeah, it's exactly like there is no darshan switch that you turn on. Okay, I'm trying to get to this. Your eyes are always looking and they're taking in information. And there's not some switch that you're supposed to turn on before looking at a sacred image. Although maybe for people who aren't familiar with it, there is, like you're saying, preparing the space, preparing for the experience of profound seeing of an image. There could be things to do. But when I went to the Hindu temple a few days ago, just walked in and was looking at the images individually, and something happened. Some shift takes place in the presence of this image. And it doesn't feel like a conscious preparing a space. You know? And this is where I'm just extremely confused, because my darshan switch was on looking at those vampire movies. I was taking in a lot of information, you know, and I just don't know how to instruct or guide people anymore, and how to look at this work differently than they look at the rest of reality.
You bring a different self to each one of those. When I went to Germany to be with an avatar, I brought an enormous amount of awe, respect, grace in preparation, and then in front of that person, that was who I was being. Whereas if I'm watching a movie, I don't bring anything like that. So I'm bringing an entirely different person in front of the space that we're talking about, the movie or the painting. And when you were raised in the way that you were raised, I imagine when you're in front of an image like that, you're bringing all of that awe and whatever those years of your teachings.
Yes.
You're not there as a blank slate.
I love the innocence of the image of the family hopping into the car and driving for 3 hours to be in the presence of the sacred image, and then heading back again. And there was the sense of a reminder. It's like a reminder where the deity is saying, "Hey, I'm here," and I'm very aware of the space between where the family packed into the car and drove off, just a reminder, and then it goes back again. Something about a reminder of sacred space, something about the sacred becoming a part of the natural environment, becoming an environmental phenomenon. Ultimately, the moment itself is sacred. And we forget that, so we need reminders.
Mm-hmm.
We need reminders. And the sacred itself, if we go too long without it, will find a way to remind us, even if it's,
yes,
even if it's with death. But the idea of reminders, I think, is...
Can you tell us more about the painting that you're showing now?
Yes, yes.
And who she is and what, mm-hmm, she represents.
And I will touch on the reminder thing and then bring it into, mm-hmm, to this piece. The figurative aesthetic has gone out of style in the West in some ways. Figurative meaning images of people, paintings with people in them. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you think of this, it's an individual, you know. In my house growing up, we had paintings and statues of gods, either close up of the head or of a full body, and it was a constant reminder. You were always being watched, is kind of how you would view it. You were being watched, you were under the gaze, but it wasn't this big brother gaze, it was a loving, compassionate gaze. And so that was a reminder. Because like I said, you couldn't go anywhere in the home and avoid that. You had a constant reminder of the sacred, wherever you were. This is a form of Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva of compassion. So he's also Kuan Yin. Kuan Yin is an emanation of this figure. Considered, like you said, quite androgynous. In this tradition, the top part of the body is supposed to look like a man, and the bottom portion like a woman. And this is him in his form as the lotus bearer. This is the patron deity of Kathmandu, you could say. With incredible detail, if you were to look with a magnifying glass, you'd see tiny animals in these medallions behind. Mm.
It's very graceful. That's why I thought it was a feminine form. Mm-hmm. It's just beautiful.
It's like I've lost the words to talk about this kind of art. Because it is, to me, this is incredibly beautiful. And it's incredibly evocative. And it touches a very, very deep, profound place. And yet, how do you talk about that? How?
Well, maybe you can talk about the different places these things, to make the distinctions that you seem to want to make but are having a hard time making. Maybe one way to do that is to talk about where in you a evocation, the evocative quality is arising. So, with the vampire stuff, with pornography, with these images, with the Greek mm-hmm. gods and goddesses that you were talking about earlier, what's the difference in terms of where what's being evoked where within this the ambit of that organism? Right,
yes.
There? Sure.
With some of these images, it's as if my heart were crying, is the experience I have with a lot of the sacred art. With these Newar paintings in particular, I'm so deeply in love with this movement. It's all I do and think and see.
Kind of interesting, the word beautiful hadn't come up before, and in contrast with sacred art, I felt like there was some kind of clue in that. But beautiful, I think, is pretty understandable to people, and it does melt something or take it beyond. Anyway, that's my experience of beauty, is that it becomes an experience of something indescribable, ungraspable, something like that. Whereas sacred art, I have more of the feeling that there's an intention in it, that I might be influenced by the idea of objective art. A secondhand story, a friend of mine who's an architect, we were talking about Gothic cathedrals, and he said when he was in Wells Cathedral in England, there was a choir. They got to go in, and there was a choir of boys singing, rehearsing something. And he said when they reached a certain, vibration, he saw the walls of the building vibrating in response to the singing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sure that was intentional.
Wow.
And he says nothing in architecture, people don't understand what they did then to create that.
Yes.
But we live in a world that is flooded with images. We're all bombarded.
Yes.
And, I've been affected by ancient art, by icons, and also some modern things that maybe aren't beautiful even, or
mm-hmm.
images of perfection.
Yes.
But they touch something.
Exactly. And that's what I'm having a hard time distinguishing now, is the sacred art, what I've always called it, sacred art that I deal in, is actually just things that I consider so incredibly beautiful. And they point to a reality that's bigger and better than the reality in my head. And I think that's why I sometimes have the experience that, like, my heart wants to cry. Even in the gruesome images of Kali or Chinnamasta, the goddess cutting off her head, that I've brought in here before, and the blood spilling right back into her mouth, into her head that she's holding, it's this sublime beauty that leaves you kind of speechless, and it feels very real.
Do you find that the images in this kind of art take you to a consistent place? Will one piece take you to a consistent place, or does it change with the mood that you bring to the piece?
Kristen.
It's always changing. It's always, always changing.
I think sometimes there can be a personal relationship. For instance, that Ganesha in the window, In general, I wouldn't have liked that kind of thing, but I was sitting here one night, and it looked at me, and I looked back at it, and its face was a real elephant god, and so now I feel like I have a relationship with that particular mass over there.
15% off.
That's the night only.
I have a question.
Yes.
So in Japan, there's the Cherry Blossom Festival.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, sometimes you'll see, the people will get in their cars and they'll drive hours to a particular stand of cherry blossoms because this is the weekend where they're going to do their display.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you'll see people just stand there in this worshipful, awe-struck way. Do you think that that's darshan?
I think, like I said, I'm losing the definition I used to have, and it's clarifying here. I think seeing beauty that makes you feel so small in some ways, or beauty that is so immense and deep, is actually darshan, the experience of an auspicious seeing. Which is why you can have darshan of mountains and things. Mount Kailash, for example. People just go, all they do is look at it. There's nothing to do there. There's no a spiritual amusement park or anything on top of Mount Kailash. You just go and you walk around it and you just look at it. But it's awe-inspiring.
Is it awe-inspiring for everyone or certain people?
See, these are the questions I'm really starting to wrestle with now. Is Hindu art really awe-inspiring to me? Because I'm Hindu, but you know, but the other painting's just some green snake lady. You know, like, it could really be perceived as science fiction to somebody.
Yeah, I look at it images. And it evokes absolutely nothing. I'd like it to. Perhaps if you describe the symbolism to me and I had more of a relationship with
yes.
it, then the next time it would be more dimensional to me.
Yes.
But for the moment, it's...
And that's really what it takes. That is my job, is to go through the images and, you know, say this is Green Tara and she's young and beautiful like a 16-year-old. And
that one I really was fond to, but it's something about the cold, the blue around it is a... And her contrast with it, there's something about that that really touches me. It's not like she's in this universe of shape. I can't quite even verbalize it correctly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But some of the others that are maybe prettier don't really...
Yes.
I don't connect with. I mean, it's...
Yes.
It's relative.
And one of the hard things in the West is, just as I was saying, figurative art, but religious art. It's really, really passé right now. I was in Santa Fe about a week and a half ago, and went into the Church of St. Francis that's there. And I love any kind of religious art. I don't have a problem with the Catholic, like all Catholics. I don't have a problem. It's very cool to say that you hate the Catholic Church right now. And I wasn't raised in that tradition. I don't really have an issue with it because I didn't grow up in it. I love looking at images of the Virgin Mary, and I love to see various forms of Christ. And, you know, there were people, you know, someone I was with just did not want to go in. It was such like a strong reaction to what the church stands for and all of these, you know, associations they had with it. But to me, like sacred art of any kind, it has something in it. And there was this Christ on a cross that was the most disturbing one I've ever seen. He had a wig of human hair, real hair, and was just bleeding, like, everywhere, and these big, fat nails. Like, it was really a really scary image of Christ. And yet, you know, I was fascinated by it. And that's the kind of thing, you know, people will sometimes say, well, Hindu art's so strange, you've got elephants and you've got monkeys and things. And I think, like, you guys have a guy, like, nailed to wood, you know, like, that's pretty unusual as well. But it's if you have the openness to learning more about it, like, oh, you know, Christ on the cross with the nails. I'm not, like, it doesn't make me want to worship him, like, to see him suffering that way. But then when you learn the story of it, and you put it in context, it's actually quite a powerful image, you know? So I guess what I'm saying, this is a real, it's like a really tight can of worms that's worth opening up and exploring. Although I can't define things as clearly as I used to be able to, I still do not doubt at all the power that sacred art has to affect one's being, and the importance of having sacred imagery around you.
But you still haven't, you know, the one thing that I keep going back to is that there's something that makes that art sacred.
Yes.
That's different than, let's say, selling pornography.
Yes.
Or vampire movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you're not, you don't have a video store, and you're not selling postcards on the street or something like that. There's something about this art that we can all sort of agree to use this term sacred, and there's an evocative quality to it. And, you know, if I think of it geometrically, to me, when I look at those images, it doesn't matter what the image is, there's something ascending about the experience that I have there, which is very different than looking at pornography or looking at... you know, sort of mundane entertainment. It's not that I think those things are bad or anything like that. It's just that, to Rob's point, the energy takes me to a very different place. And these pieces all have an ascension. there's something that ascends in me, and it's, I can't put my finger on it more specifically than that, but there's something that takes me up.
Yes.
And it may have a different flavor, like an emotional flavor, an intellectual flavor. It may change with a different piece or different points, but the direction's always very mm-hmm. similar.
I think I have the same experience. They don't all take me to the same place, but they all inspire me in some way.
There's a very famous sort of like father of contemporary art named Joseph Beuys,
mm-hmm.
who was considered a shaman. But this notion of darshan that you sort of introduced, I've never heard of it before, but a lot of his teachings had to do with the notion you're presenting of what is the dialogue. So in a lot of his installations, he would do kind of like you're doing tonight. With his art, he would present a question or something that evoked a question, because he felt like the dialogue is the only real darshan that we have
mm-hmm.
between us and whatever it is. Whatever meaning people put into that art, whether it's a piece of felt or a painting, we're talking about meaning, which, like you're saying, it can be kind of overwhelming because the meaning might not have been consciously put there. It might have been mm-hmm. allowed to happen. So when we encounter it and try to make sense out of it.
Yeah. You can't in some of these. It's just, or you, it's, it is, I completely agree. It's about the dialogue or it's about the relationship. And I think that's what I'm just starting to get after talking about darshan for a long time. One full talk on the subject, 2 hours long, with 60 people wrapped around my finger. And now it's like, uh-oh, I wasn't really talking about it. It is about that experience.
So in a number of different spiritual traditions, in terms of, you know, this kind of an emotional response, emotional center, heart center response, which is a large part at least of what you're talking about at least. But there's also this tradition of examination of through a medium. It might be reading Torah,
mm-hmm.
constantly rereading and rereading Torah, or it might be the Psalms, or it might be some other practice like that where there's this this dialogical process that you guys are talking about. But it seems to me that one of the things that makes it this different is in fact that in our fourth way terminology, this does affect, this goes directly to the heart center in a way that some of those other traditions don't do, some of those other practices, I should say, don't do in quite that way. And that's one of the things that makes it hard to talk about, I think, especially if you start really reflecting on what's going on as you're doing that. So, yeah. but I would encourage, you know, as I think the last questioner suggested implicitly, you know, this process of dialogue is probably part of what you're supposed to be doing. To learn how to teach people about darshan even better in the future.
Yes. Like I was saying earlier to you, I feel like something with the integrity. I'm bringing more integrity to the subject matter by not being such an expert anymore. And I'm going to be gone for 3 months this winter, working on different articles and things, but mostly just looking and really focusing on what is my experience when I look at these things. What's actually happening? Where is it going? And how can others kind of experience art this way? Or experience these images that way?
There's an analogy that I think of from some powerful impressions I've had in studying the Shakuhachi, because I work with a teacher who is brilliant at teaching his students how to open up parts of themselves, like opening up your third eye or opening up your heart center and imbuing the music with that. And I've had very clear objective experiences both in listening to him and occasionally being able to demonstrate that in my own playing, mm-hmm. where the quality of the sound is quite different because of the awakeness with which he or I am able to imbue the production of that sound.
Yes.
And so I see an interesting analogy here, because that thing I can't touch, that ascending quality in these pictures, seems to me at least partly a function of the intention that was consistently applied by the artist in producing the image and where they were at. And it's not just the colors and the pigments, there's something there, there's something conscious there that's qualitatively and objectively different than other images that we have in our society. And they contain the possibility of us, when that quality is present, we have the possibility of that resonating within us. We don't have to see that. It's not obligatory that we see that, and it's not automatic. We have to, as you said about darshan, have a two-way. Mm-hmm. There's a opening yourself to be,
yes.
and there's the other part that's seen. And so that is part of the equation. Those pieces have that intention, and if we bring an opening to that, then that ascension can take place. But it's like this alchemical process that requires several elements to make the whole thing,
yeah.
you know, effective.
Yes. Like they'll say in India, you make one step towards God, God takes 10 steps towards you. If you approach these images with perhaps just the slightest intention that you're going to benefit from looking, that there's something here from you, that might be just enough to actually experience like this beautiful depth or ascension that you talk about.
I think that's the mystical thing that you started off using that word, mysticism. And we've talked mostly about the intention of the artist or the intention of the viewer. But maybe there are aspects of the universe which, when filtered through our minds, we can call divine or deities or whatever, or bodhisattvas, that also have the intention to be expressed.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the artist opens herself or himself up to that, then you can have something like that. And if the viewer does that, makes the same intention, creates the same intention of Stur's calling it ascending or ascension or something, and I would just say expansion. If you open yourself, then that's what's going on. But the deity or the universe or however whatever word we want to use are mutually creating this.
Yes.
Together, and so I like that the expression about you take one step, but God takes 10 steps. That's nice.
Let's hope it's true.
But mystic wouldn't doubt it. Or the mystic would have the experience.
I want to thank everyone for being open to my not being as much an expert as I was several months ago. and for participating, because it's really helping me understand this more. I'm going to be away, like I said, through the winter, but hopefully I'll be back in the spring. I would love to come back and do a more specific event based on my fact-finding mission in Nepal.
And you should plug your auction.
I will plug this auction. I am so far, I can't even like think straight. I am in over my head on this massive project I am doing, but I can't even think about it now because it's a week away. All I'm doing is the best I can. It's a benefit auction to raise money for a group called Himalayan Healthcare that do medical work in Nepal. They opened a hospital in 2004, and it's serving 400,000 people. So it's a lot of people for this hospital, and now they want to create a maternal care center to provide safe childbirth, and a lot of the complications that happen in this region are around pregnancy and childbirth. So I'm hosting an auction of sacred art, paintings, prints, and bronzes in Berkeley. There are over 100 pieces in the auction. Bidding is opening at about 50 to 70% off of everything in this auction.
What time?
The preview starts at 6 o'clock on Saturday, November 10th. The auction begins at 8. I haven't really focused on this movement, the paintings in this collection. They are truly the finest contemporary Hindu and Buddhist paintings there are, that you can find. And when you see them in person, you can really, really tell. So this is a fantastic opportunity to see incredible work, to acquire incredible work, and to support a really great cause. So I encourage you to attend if you're free. There's postcards there with more information. My website has a lot of the images on it if you want to see. And if you know other people who'd like to attend, please spread the word. This is the first auction like this ever in the Bay Area, exclusively sacred art. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was really wonderful.
Yeah.
Truly. So, most of you know the drill. We have our donation bowl over there, which we hope you will contribute to, and we share that, of course, with our speakers. And the postcards are right next to the donation bowl there.
And behind you are some images that
indeed.
We get
carry
from Siddhartha.
Store, as well as over here in this over here. And Siddhartha has some stuff you can look at, I'm sure.
Yeah, I have so many paintings.